Programming is supported by Topline Construction Firm, your local women-owned roofing contractor based out of Shoreview, Minnesota. Roof replacement, both retail and insurance work. More information at toplineconstructionfirm.com.
Good morning. I'm Ewan Kerr, sitting in for Kerry Miller. Over the next hour, we will get three views from places in the news around the world. The death toll in a suicide bombing at a wedding in Turkey over the weekend has risen to 54, including 22 children. The Turkish government today said it will, quote, completely cleanse ISIS, the terror group it blames for the attack, and it will also close its southern border. It's just the latest development in the conflict spilling over from neighboring Syria. We'll talk about both those situations. We'll also hear from Venezuela, where government mismanagement and plunging oil prices have come together to create economic chaos, including triple-digit inflation and shortage of basic supplies. But first, we turn to Brexit. 2 months ago, British voters shocked the world, and possibly even themselves, by voting to leave the European Union. The so-called Brexit vote sent ripples through the world, with many people struggling to understand why this had happened and how it could be actually accomplished. Things got even more complicated when first British Prime Minister David Cameron, who had promised the referendum as an election campaign pledge, but then campaigned to remain in Europe, stepped down. And it seemed almost just as quickly many of the anti-EU campaigners, including the flamboyant Boris Johnson, also stepped back from leadership when it became clear that some of the promises they had been making didn't hold water. Now, new Prime Minister Theresa May faces the task of negotiating an exit in a process which is fraught with peril and could take years. Joining us to try and make sense of what is happening now is BBC political reporter Matt Cole. He joins us from London. Good day to you.
Hello, Ewan.
Hello, hello.
Hello, hi.
So what is the mood now on the streets 2 months post-Brexit?
I think a substantial number of people are still rather wide-eyed with astonishment that the result was for Brexit. I don't think certainly any of the political elite saw it coming. I think plenty of people in the small towns and villages up and down the UK probably had more of an inkling that the trend of public mood was beginning to drift that way as we went to the vote. But here we are 2 months later, almost to the day, and a lot of people are thinking, well, what has actually happened since? There's no sign that the mechanism for leaving the European Union has been triggered. No sign, perhaps, that it will be for quite some months, if not longer. The departments that are being set up for leading the UK out of the UK, they're not fully formed yet. They're not fully staffed. And so a lot of people are looking at Brexit and wondering, well, actually, what does it mean? And some are wondering, will it even ever happen?
Well, that's a question that has been asked many, many times here in the US. I mean, there was this sense that the European Union leaders wanted the process to start as quickly as possible. But Prime Minister May has said she's in no hurry, didn't want to rush into anything. And then there's the complicating factor of upcoming elections in Europe, in France and in Germany. How is that? I mean, do we actually have a guess as to when the Article 50 may be invoked and the process gets started?
Yeah, Article 50 is the mechanism from the European Union's rule book that a country can trigger to leave. Once it's triggered, which is done by the country which wants to leave, going to one of the key ruling bodies of the European Union, the Council of the European Union, saying, we want to leave. And once that happens, there's then a two-year period in which negotiations on the exit take place. So it's very clear that the UK government wants to have some idea of what it wants out of those exit negotiations before triggering that mechanism. And given, as you're saying in the introduction, no one really thought this was coming, certainly not David Cameron, who was the Prime Minister. And therefore, there was almost nothing, if nothing, done behind the scenes in the government departments, Whitehall, as it's known over here, to represent the area of London where the government departments are based. No real discussions in Whitehall about how this was to happen. So the idea of triggering Article 50 to get Britain out of the EU, well, at the moment, the Prime Minister, Theresa May, says certainly not before the end of this year. Some are now thinking probably not even next year. Of course, that, you mentioned elections in France and Germany, would mean we'd steer clear of upsetting sentiment on the continent, because this is an issue. If things are offered to Britain that are favourable, then there might be voters in Germany and France who themselves might think, do you know what, we will vote for parties in our country that could take them out of the European Union if you can get a good deal. So there are some thinking, do you know what, it's better just to steer well clear of those elections to make sure that sentiment isn't agitated, ending up with Britain getting a bad deal. So you could get sometime in 2018, and if that was the case, I mentioned it takes 2 years for this process to then take place, that could take Britain's electoral cycle into 2020 when the next general election is due here. I don't think the government will necessarily want to see their negotiations taken over by another party if someone else gets into government. So it's complicated, and it's factors like these that are making people wonder how this will all be possible before we even get into the detail of how you negotiate yourself out of 40 years of combined integrated legislation.
Well, I mean, that in itself is just mind-boggling. I mean, you've got trade deals, you've got border issues, you've got movement of people, you've got agricultural policies. And then on top of that, there's the whole thing about the UK is part of so many European Union trade agreements, which would then be, they'd have to basically be renegotiated with countries all around the world. And that's going to take, some might even say, decades.
Well, some do wonder that. Some wonder that the deal with the European Union alone could take longer. You have to imagine that those 2 years of negotiations that see Britain leaving the European Union, a lot of that focus will be on some of the simple things like how much money the UK has put into the EU budget it will now need back because it won't be part of the EU for the full 7 year cycle of the budget. How many of the EU institutions are based here in London, for example, that will need to uproot and relocate? What will happen to the staff? What will happen to British staff who are based over in the EU? What will happen to British citizens who, under the freedom of movement and settlement rights of the EU, currently live, for example, in retirement in Spain? Will they still be allowed, or will they be extradited back here? The same happens. What of the couple of million EU citizens who live in the UK? So the much of those 2 years of negotiations, once Article 50 is triggered, will focus on that. The trade deal the UK will do with the EU alone might then take some years after, something maybe a decade. And then there are the questions of doing a deal, for example, with the United States. President Obama said Britain would go to the back of the queue if there was a Brexit. There'd be questions of whether you could do quick deals with Brazil, India, Australia, perhaps some of the former Commonwealth nations with which something Britain will still share some affinity with. But these things take time. And one of the fundamental problems you just sort of touched on, I suppose, there is a question of negotiations and the negotiators to do those negotiations, because Britain at the moment has, it's a thought, a lack perhaps of negotiators, because most of the international trade deals that will have been done by British people in recent times will be done as part of the European Union. One of the reasons that some voted to leave the EU is because while you are a member, all of your international trade deals are done collectively as a bloc. You cannot do your own, you have to do it as a bloc. Some people therefore think by leaving Britain we'll get better deals, but we don't have the negotiators at the moment. There are some thoughts that we only perhaps have 10% of the negotiators we need. If you look, for example, at the recent deal done between the EU and Canada, the suggestions that Canada had something like 300 negotiators working on that. Britain doesn't have anything like that number at the moment, nor do the departments for leaving the EU, which has been set up, nor the new Department for International Trade, which has also been set up to help see this Brexit process through. They don't have full offices yet. There's some talk that even some of their meetings are happening in Starbucks and other kind of coffee houses while they wait for their full offices to be up and running. So there are many, many practical problems before you even get to the political.
There's something Pythonesque about this. I mean, I was reading some very wry comments about how, despite the claims from the Leave campaign that this was going to save all sorts of money, there's now huge amounts of cash being spent on hiring European law experts all over London to try and work out what the heck's going on. So anyway,
there are, yeah, indeed. No, these are the sort of, and in terms of money involved, a lot of people who voted for Remain rather wryly, shall we say, pointed out that the UK stock market fell the following day by amounts in the billions of pounds more than the contributions that the UK had been giving on an annual basis to the EU. And certainly people are plucking figures almost out of the air, to be honest, to how much this could potentially cost. Those who are in favour of Brexit, though, turn around and say, look, once Britain has got through this turbulent period, we will be in a position where we can negotiate much better free trade deals or other deals with nations and suddenly boost the British economy and accelerate beyond the European Union. The problem that both sides have on this and had throughout the campaigning is that no one actually has the full answers and no one will really know until it's happened. And how do you make it happen? Well, at the moment, again, there are more questions than answers.
Well, one other thing I understand is we have the so-called People's Challenge involved in the discussions, and this is a lawsuit which claims that any negotiated deal to leave the EU has to be put to a parliamentary vote. And, of course, there's a feeling that the UK Parliament actually leans pro-Europe. Might this have a big impact?
Potentially. Again, there are a group, I think it's about seven different legal cases have been brought together into one, which is due to be started. I think the hearings are due to start in October. And some of these are from sort of big legal firms, because you have to remember the city as a block, the financial hub of London, didn't want this to happen. And therefore, I suppose, no surprise, some of their rather expensive lawyers have got together and have started some legal fun and games, shall we say, with some of this. Now, some of those legal cases are challenging points like that. Should there be a parliamentary vote? The majority is probably about 2-1, 2/3 to 1/3 within the House of Commons, the MPs, in favour of staying in the UK. And therefore, one gets into a question, if there is a deal done and 2 years down the line, legal sources say that, yes, Parliament has to vote on this. It can't just be the gift of the Prime Minister to trigger Britain's exit. If that's the case, you'd then have a rather difficult position. Do MPs who are put there with a mandate of their own say, I'm going to vote with a mandate given to me by the public and I'm going to vote to stay in and dismiss this referendum result? Or do they go with the referendum result? Now, it was 52% to 48% in favour. It was therefore close. And what's more, only 2/3 of the electorate actually took the time to vote. 1/3 didn't. So in terms of an overall mandate from the UK, 1/3 of British voters voted, give or take a few percentage points, to leave the EU. So that might leave some MPs thinking, you know, there isn't a mandate there. But politically, that could be a very costly thing for them to reject. And so these are the, again, there are difficulties in working out how this will play down because we are in uncharted territory. There are plenty of pundits with much sort of greyer hair than mine who've never seen the likes of this in all their years. And so everyone is rather feeling their way in the dark with this. So whether Brexit takes place, whether all these negotiations are in the long grass and how it will all fade out is very, very difficult to fathom. And I think anyone who can give you absolute wisdom on how it will play out is probably not quite telling the truth.
And then on top of that, there's always the belief that many people think it won't happen. But I know you've got a very busy day today and we have to let you go. But BBC political reporter Matt Cole in London, thank you very much for at least beginning to explain the complexities of the Brexit extraction to us. Thank you very much for joining us today.
You and you're most welcome.
The numbers in the Venezuelan crisis speak for themselves. Inflation is currently running at 720% this year. It's expected to hit 2,200% next year. The International Monetary Fund estimates the Venezuelan economy will shrink by 10% this year. There are five-hour lines at grocery stores. And recently, when the government opened the border with Colombia for 12 hours, 85,000 Venezuelans poured over the border to go shopping for basics. 100,000 went last weekend at another temporary opening. There are reports of people working the fields to grow food in what amounts to a forced labor situation, and now malaria, once eradicated in the country, is spreading rapidly. To discuss the crisis, the situation in Venezuela, I'm joined via Skype by Andes bureau chief at the New York Times, Nicholas Casey. He's in Caracas. Thanks for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
So this is just a horribly complicated situation, but I'm going to ask you to do the impossible and give me a thumbnail of how did Venezuela, which has the largest oil reserves on the planet, get into this situation?
Well, it's a question that I think Venezuelans also wake up every day and ask themselves as well, because, you know, just 12, 15 years ago, this country was one of the richest in the region. It's an OPEC member. This is not a country which should be going hungry for food at this point. But over the years, mainly during the years of Hugo Chavez and his leftist successors, there were a number of changes to the economy that economists said made the country into a more difficult place to do business. There were a number of nationalizations that took place. There were currency controls that happened, making it harder to get dollars. And the price of many goods, many goods got fixed. So for things, some of the basics that people buy, it became cheaper to import them from abroad than to actually make them in Venezuela. What happened afterward was that the price of oil started to fall. And that meant that Venezuela couldn't pay for these things that it was beginning to import. And that's when the big problem started to happen here. That's when you started to see disappearances of things, because the country couldn't produce some of the basic goods that it needed to get by on a daily basis. And the oil money wasn't supporting it to be able to import those things from outside of the country. And that's the situation that we're in right now.
So I mean, I think a lot of people here in the United States would have problems just getting their heads around what this really means. I mean, what is it like on the streets? How are people reacting? How are they having to live on a daily basis?
People are having to come up with increasingly creative solutions to problems which they haven't seen before. One example that almost everybody sees when they come here for the first time is the long lines that people are having to wait to get food. If you buy food at price-controlled prices, you have to wait for it. And a lot of people can't afford anything else besides that. And that means that they might be in a line that goes on for 50 people, 100 people, sometimes even 1,000 people are waiting to get something from the grocery store. That something at the other end of the line, which these stores aren't filled with a lot of things to begin with. Sometimes I've been to the front of the line where there's only cooking oil and sugar at the front of the line. That can be common here. If you go out into the countryside, you begin to see that there's nothing being produced. There's whole fields that are laying fallow right now. And the reason isn't because the farmers don't want to grow their crops, but they've told me when I've been out there, it's because they can't get fertilizer or seeds right now. So on one end, you have no production. On the other end, you have no, very little consumption because there's not much to be bought. And that's the situation that Venezuelans are kind of waking up in on a daily basis.
We've heard these stories about, how can I put this? There's been a suggestion from the government that people should maybe take vacation for a couple of months and go and work in the fields to try and get things going out there. But this is, in a way, it basically amounts to forced labor. I mean, is that really the case?
Well, that's not happening because Venezuelans realize there's no money to be made if they take off vacation and go work in a crop, especially one that doesn't have any fertilizer, doesn't have any chance of producing. What is happening, though, and what I've been reporting on, is how many Venezuelans have left their jobs, sometimes professional jobs, to go work in gold mines. There are thousands of people right now who are leaving jobs from being taxi drivers, waiters, people who were government bureaucrats who actually just took their time off 2 weeks, 3 weeks to go work in a gold mine. And there, it's become one of the last places in Venezuela when you're not earning in the local currency, you're earning money in gold, that you can actually make something of a living for yourself, although you're living in circumstances that you couldn't have imagined. If you're someone that got a master's degree, which I did meet people that had left to go and work in a mine.
Your story about that was published in the Times quite recently, and it's horrendous. It's horrifying in many ways. People who are working in very dangerous conditions, and people, young women being forced to turn to prostitution, anything to try and make ends meet. And then on top of all this, you write about how this is spreading malaria, which was once eradicated in Venezuela.
Yeah, well, this is one of the places that you see the kind of a deadly mix of what's happening in the economy with infectious disease. As these immigrants have been coming to this mine, they've been leaving the mine with malaria. is. She said malaria has been eradicated mostly in Venezuela, except for some of the fringes. And one of the fringes was these mines that people were going to. Now, if you go to the mine and you spend 2 or 3 weeks, you earn some money, you go back to where you came from, that town, that city that you came from, and you've gotten malaria, you've got malaria in your blood. Now, malaria can't be passed person to person, but it is passed by the mosquitoes. So what we're seeing has started to happen is that these miners, if they come back to their towns, get bitten by mosquitoes, and those mosquitoes are starting to spread malaria person to person in places where you hadn't seen malaria in years. Malaria right now in Venezuela has reached levels higher, doctors say, than it's been in 75 years. And it's now in half of the states of Venezuela at this point. It's turned into a very serious outbreak and turning into a crisis right now at a time where in the rest of the world, malaria is being defeated. Yet in Venezuela, where there also are a huge lack of medicine because of the same economic crisis, you're seeing it spread really rapidly.
Our topic this morning is the crisis in Venezuela. I'm joined via Skype by New York Times and his bureau chief, Nicholas Casey. Now, critics say the problems here stem back to the policies of the charismatic president Hugo Chavez, who died in 2013. And he drove through his reforms, which, I mean, quite often it seemed it was as much by the power of his personality as anything else. I mean, when he died, did the vacuum he left really exacerbate things?
There were two things that happened when Chavez passed that I think almost any Venezuelan political scientist feared most. One was that they lost who had become their most charismatic leader. Hugo Chavez was beloved by a number of Venezuelans. He won by large amounts during the times that he was elected, regardless of whether you agree or disagree with how he transformed the country. When he was gone, that left a bit of a power vacuum. The other thing that happened was that there was a vacuum of money that was left. This country was being funded by oil revenues. And when those revenues started to fall, you both had no leader that could sort of hold the glue together, you know, as it were, in Venezuela, and nothing to fund this with was the problem. And that's the situation that Venezuela is in right now.
So, I mean, I suppose, first of all, is there any hope that the government under current President Nicolas Maduro, is it up to the job?
That's a difficult question to answer. And I think they're trying to answer that both in the government and outside of the government right now. Maduro was handed an extremely difficult hand. No one knew that Chavez was going to die when he did years ago. He got cancer. He was young for the cancer that he got. He had been talking about being president for decades afterward. So what Maduro inherited was little money and not the same support that Chavez had enjoyed for years. And the truth is, it's been a huge struggle. A lot of the opposition has taken the opportunity to push for a referendum to try to use the laws that Venezuela has to recall him from office. And he's been having to fight that. He's been having to deal with challenges that Hugo Chavez never faced.
And of course, the surrounding countries must be very, very concerned about what's going on here because obviously Venezuela was a very important economic powerhouse and it's gone and it probably leads to instability in the whole region.
Absolutely. There was a lot of stability, you know, over the 20th century from Venezuela because it was the oil power in the area because it was one of the richest countries. And now you're seeing the reverse. You're seeing people from Venezuela trying to get out. You're seeing neighbors of Venezuela fearful of immigration, of people who might be poor, who might be criminals. There's a new stigma for the first time that comes with being Venezuelan when you're abroad. You're seeing a brain drain of people who are leaving the country and going elsewhere. But also with things that we discussed here, like infectious disease, economic problems, these are contagious in other parts of the region. And I think there's a lot of uncertainty about what happens next in Venezuela and what the consequences might be for the neighbors.
So you were there in Caracas. As you talk to people, as you go around, is there any hope that this will turn around soon?
I think realistically, there's not a hope that in the short term that Venezuela is going to get better from what's going on. This is going to last for a number of years. The economic damage took years to do, and it's going to take years to get out of. But I think in the long term, Venezuelans will agree with you on this, that the country does have a bright future, and that's because of its oil. It does have something which is going to be able to eventually restart the economy. The oil is there. It's in the ground. It's just not being pumped out at the rates that it used to be, and the price of it isn't as high. I think those two things in the long term are going to turn around, and you're going to see Venezuela go back to being a rich country, even if it's not going to be in the next 3 years, 4 years, 5 years. It may be much longer than that.
But probably a lot of misery in the meantime. So thank you for joining us this morning. The New York Times Andes Bureau Chief Nicholas Casey is based in Caracas in Venezuela. His recent story describes the desperate conditions in black market gold mines in that country and the resurgence of malaria as the country struggles with economic collapse. He joined us today by Skype. Thanks very much for joining us.
Thanks so much.
In other international news, Russia announced its plans to suspend flights into Syria from Iran. The announcement came just a week after Russia said it would start bombing missions from air bases in Iran. The BBC's Khazar Naji spoke with Johnny Diamond, speculating on Russia's abrupt reversal of policy. Iran was not particularly pleased with Russia's announcement to begin with.
I think they are very embarrassed. They didn't expect this thing to be revealed to the news to get out. In fact, it was the Russian Defense Ministry that announced the news first and took Iranians by surprise. Last night, the defense minister, Iranian defense minister, went on Iranian television saying that we feel let down by the Russians. And he goes on to say that he believes that the Russians were boasting about their influence in the region and also in Iran. And today we had the spokesman for the foreign ministry in Iran saying that the planes have gone back for the time being. We don't know whether they're coming back or not. I think they probably come back. The relationship is pretty getting the shape of a strategic relationship between Iran and Russia. And I suppose for the moment that they come back, they want to sort this out. They feel embarrassed. They have to explain it to the Iranians, to the parliament, and so on and so forth. And the latest thing, I just seen it, that the Russian ambassador in Tehran has also confirmed that all the planes have gone back to Russia. They're saying that he's saying that none of our people are in Hamadan anymore. Hamadan is the place where the airbase was based.
So do you think there was something of domestic political pressure on the Iranian government to act in some way, and then it can let the Russians back in at a later date?
Absolutely. I think the Iranian officials were hoping that they can do this quietly. Giving an airbase to Russia or allowing them to use an airbase in Iran is pretty unpopular in Iran. Iranians generally look to the West as the direction for movement rather than the East. So it's generally unpopular. They wanted to keep it quiet. Now that it has come out, they have to sort of figure out how they're going to play that. The parliamentarians want to know because they say this is against the Constitution to allow Russians to have this base in Iran or the use of an airbase in Iran.
Khazar Naji, thank you very much. One to keep an eye on. Thank you.
And that was the BBC's Johnny Diamond looking at the situation in the Middle East. Going in depth now, we return to Turkey and Syria. The suicide bombing in Turkey over the weekend adds to an already complex political situation created by the recent unsuccessful coup attempt against President Erdogan's government and the subsequent crackdown, which resulted in tens of thousands of people arrested, sacked, or suspended. And this is happening as the civil war in neighboring Syria continues. An estimated 500,000 people have died in that conflict since 2011, precipitating a global refugee migration crisis. Joining us to discuss the situation is Washington Post reporter and Stern Fellow Louisa Lovelock. We've connected her with her via Skype from Washington, D.C. Good morning.
Good morning.
So this tragedy over the weekend, how does it play into the political turmoil in Turkey?
Well, it's clearly symptomatic of a huge problem. It's clear the Turks have a major problem on their hands when it comes to ISIS, and it's not one to which there's any clear solution right now. Reports suggest the group has developed a pretty deep-rooted network of cells across southern Turkey. And when the group's interests are threatened by President Erdogan's military in Syria, right across the border, we're now seeing a pattern just like this of ISIS lashing out, particularly at Kurdish targets like the wedding at the weekend.
Now, the fact that this was, I believe, the first child suicide bomber in Turkey, does this represent a new escalation?
Well, it's difficult to say. The use of child suicide bombers for ISIS in sort of general terms is certainly not unprecedented. There was also a video that kind of went viral on the internet this weekend, showing a very young suicide bomber being arrested in Iraq, a very young boy who frankly looked terrified. The problem in Turkey is that this is an entirely separate cell and one which is actually very difficult to assess the strength of right now. The use of children is clearly a tactic that's used to allow people to sort of worm their way in undetected. And unfortunately, with the tragic consequences we saw this weekend, that's what happened.
We have been hearing that there is a possibility that the southern border may be closed now between Turkey and Syria. What can you tell us about that?
Well, the southern border between Turkey and Syria has been largely closed for around a year now. The efforts have been linked not just to international pressure, but also to this rash of attacks that the militants have been unleashing on Turkish soil. Turkey was accused for years of the fact that its lax border controls were allowing fighters to travel through to ISIS territory, sort of strengthening the group and making their defeat very difficult. What rebel forces are saying now is that they're gearing up to launch an attack on ISIS's final stronghold across the Turkish border in an area called Jarablus. That said, this is a long-fated operation, and it's been heralded several times before, so it's certainly not yet clear that it really is about to start in the short term.
So, of course, President Erdogan is facing his own internal problems with the coup, or the attempted coup, which happened a couple of weeks ago, whilst also battling ISIS. I mean, how vulnerable is he as president?
Well, that's a very good question. The Turkish government had been warning for years of these secretive plots to unseat it. But certainly as a journalist who's normally based in Istanbul, I and many of my colleagues saw that there was little publicly available evidence at the time to suggest anything was amiss. What this putsch did show was that there were certainly plans in place that were far better or far more extensively planned for than anything anyone would have expected. And it really did come close to succeeding. So certainly on the night of the coup, the government was very vulnerable. In the months that followed, it certainly seems that Erdogan has really capitalized on this and turned it to his advantage. As you say, tens of thousands of opponents have been arrested, many of them allegedly Gulenists. That's the followers of a Pennsylvania-based imam who Turkey says is the sort of leader of this putsch. So it does seem that right now he's using the coup as an excuse to turn the screw on any internal opposition, and he's certainly a lot stronger for it.
Well, we've been hearing that just in recent days he's even turned his this clampdown to businesses. And, I mean, is there a danger he might go too far, or is this really just a case of him bolstering his own position?
I think both can be true at the same time. The crackdown is allegedly, as I say, targeting these Gulenists. But it's very difficult to tell at any one time who is indeed a Gulenist, even if they are a Gulenist, whether or not they're in the least bit involved in this plot, or whether this really is a way of just purging every last remainder of opposition. What is clear, and what became incredibly clear on the night of the attempted coup, is that Erdogan, despite this crackdown, does have immense popular support. When he appeared on a FaceTime connection, a very shaky FaceTime connection that a lot of people at the time thought was a sign that his rule was over, Erdogan, on the night of the coup, appealed to the millions of Turks who supported him to come out on the streets and turn against the putschists. That's exactly what they did. And the people that I speak to in Turkey right now certainly are more behind him than ever, really feeling that they have rescued the country from the brink of disaster.
Well, of course, there is this attempt to get Fethullah Gulen extradited from the U.S. And there also does seem to be a sense in Turkey that there was actually a lot of Western support for the coup. I mean, what's the basis for this? Is it just paranoia, or does it really exist?
Well, the fact that Gulen lives in Pennsylvania has long been a sort of diplomatic sticking point between the Turks and the US. And it's always something that President Erdogan's administration can come back to and point to as a sign that the US is backing his opponents. Now, if you speak to US officials here, they will tell you that although Turkey has made several requests, I believe not formally, but several sort of unofficial requests for Gulen's extradition, they have yet to provide any evidence that he was involved in the plot. And this will be crucial going forward when it comes to whether or not the US does move on this particular plan. More broadly, there are a lot of rumours that the sort of swash around Turkish society that on the night of the coup, when Erdogan was looking potentially for a way out, the US did not respond. There were certainly several media articles that said that a senior general was not woken by his staff when Turkish officials called to say it was happening. Now, both the US and Turkey have subsequently denied that, but it's rumours like this that really add to the sense that Turkey has been left on its own with the US backing the other side.
Well, and I think there's also been some concern that there hasn't been an official visit of some kind from the US official since the attempt. And I understand Vice President Biden is due to be out there fairly soon, in fact this week maybe. I mean, is that going to make a difference?
Difficult to say. It will certainly smooth over the optics, but from the US's point of view at the moment, there is a very real concern about being seen on a diplomatic visit to a country where the president's government is rounding up tens of thousands of people in a purge that is, being widely decried by human rights groups. We've seen very compelling evidence to suggest that there is widespread torture going on in Turkish prisons of the people that they've been arrested. So, it's a very difficult time for a US official to sort of breeze in, say the right thing and leave, given how it will look to human rights groups and all the criticism that will follow.
Our guest this morning is Washington Post reporter Louisa Lovelock. We've connected with her via Skype from Washington, D.C. Now, of course, this is all happening against the backdrop of the ongoing civil war in Syria, and the world was shocked again by an image of a child sitting in an emergency vehicle encrusted in dust and blood after being rescued from a building hit by an airstrike. I mean, what does it say to you as a reporter covering this situation that a single image like that can draw such attention and sympathy when these overwhelming statistics about the horrible conflict do not?
I think that's a great question and one we should really be asking ourselves right now. I mean, speaking personally as a reporter who covers Syria, I'm a member of several WhatsApp groups, Skype groups, through which I am sent often real-time images of the death and destruction that, really is a sort of a daily feature of life in Syria, particularly in East Aleppo, where Omran Dagnish, the child you referred to, was injured. And for myself, this image, while it was incredibly sad, it didn't necessarily stand out as compared to the others that you receive on a daily basis. What we now realize is that this image was just slightly more relatable. It was the sort of image that we could put on our front pages. There wasn't too much blood. There wasn't too much sort of damage to the child. And while he has become this sort of symbol, I was very struck by the fact that my own stories and the stories of my colleagues about his plight, they went viral and they were shared all around the world. 2 days later, His 10-year-old brother was actually died of his injuries, and that was the story that did not get widely picked up. So I think that this was a small, digestible moment that we were able, as I say, to stick on the front pages. News anchors were able to cry about it on television, but you speak to the doctors in Syria, and they will say, we still feel abandoned. This interest has not translated into any form of concrete action, and we are still dying daily.
Of course, we have the news today that the Russians are suspending their airstrikes from Iran, but there was growing concern that the Russian action could actually signal that Russia is stepping closer to the loose coalition between President Bashar al-Assad, Iran, and Hezbollah. And this could really spell doom for the Syrian opposition. What's your sense of what is actually happening?
Well, it was never entirely clear whether or not this was a sort of a short-term move or something that the Russians were intending to do in the long term. What we have seen over the past week is Russia making a real show of its sort of flexing its military muscles. Not only has it effectively shown that it can strike targets in Syria from anywhere, not only did it launch those airstrikes from an Iranian airbase, but it also launched cruise missiles for the first time from the Mediterranean. It's not clear that these things are going to continue, but these are just signs to the international community, particularly as Russia is involved in negotiations with the US, that it is a force to be reckoned with and one that should be taken seriously diplomatically. Now, one of the problems here is that while, of course, we did see this cooperation with Iran, the power that Russia has over the regime is certainly not the same as Iran's. And it's not clear that even if Russia does sort of lapse into these bouts of diplomacy, that it can compel the government to do anything. And while Iran is backing the regime to the hilt, and while Iran continues to want the country to be won back full scale, not divided, it's not in the least bit clear that diplomatic action with Russia will do anything in the near future.
It was interesting to me that the Iranians were actually more concerned that the Russians had revealed that it was happening than actually that the Russian planes were flying from Iran than that the fact that they were flying from Iran.
Well, I think as your previous guest said, you know, domestically in Iran, this has not been a popular move. This is the first foreign mission to fly out of an Iranian airbase since at least World War II. And in Iran, which I should say is a country that I don't usually report on, you know, this is a country that has long been very, very isolationist, and I don't think that the appearance of Russian jets on their soil went down very well at all.
Of course, we've been talking about the civil war, and the other huge issue here is the refugees. We've not been hearing so much about them recently, even though they're still apparently flowing out and across the Mediterranean. What is your sense of what's happening there? Is the outflow just going to keep continuing?
I think the outflow is going to keep continuing until this war comes to an end, not just until this war comes to an end, but as well until there is some sort of rebuilding in a country, which means people finally feel that they can come back. The Turkey-EU refugee deal certainly has made something of a difference for the flow coming out through Turkey. But of course, as long as the war continues, people will continue to find other routes to get out. They are that desperate. And I think as the images from Aleppo showed this weekend, there's a very good reason people are leaving.
I get the sense that this was, in some ways, a fairly pivotal week for what's happening in that area, what with the Russian bombings and with the move that President Erdogan against ISIS. I mean, do you sense a shift, or is this just more of the same?
Now, at this stage, I'm minded to say it's more of the same. We've seen many alleged sort of pivotal moments over the past few years, and they really haven't changed very much at all. This is a war that, even if there is some sort of diplomatic solution grinding into view, it could well continue for another 5 years or even another 10 years. One of the most interesting developments this weekend was the US announcement that it had scrambled its flights to eastern Syria after regime planes appeared to attack an area where American and coalition special operation forces were working alongside Kurdish and Arab opposition fighters. That was, I think, a very good illustration of just how tense the Syrian battlefield is right now, and just how ambiguous some of the alliances are.
It's just such a complicated and mind-boggling situation. Thank you for trying to sort it out for us. We've been joined today by our guest, Washington Post reporter Louisa Lovelock, connected to her via Skype from Washington, D.C. Thank you very much, and we look forward to talking to you again about this.
Thank you.